I'm going to call you back for the wrap-up roundtable. We're going to recommence. Before we do, I'm going to take a minute of time to thank some people. I'm going to thank the presenters, including the presenters who are talking behind me. Thank you so much to the presenters at this conference, including the group of 30 students from across the country who got us started so well and set the table for us and reminded us of the urgency of the situation and the opportunities and the intelligence of the people going forward. Thank you to the artists who worked with us this morning to show us an entirely different way of looking at the questions that we're considering in this conference. Thank you to our partners who have helped to fund this conference, the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, our sister university down the street, Concordia University, the Jackman Institute for the Humanities at the University of Toronto, and of course, our home base, our foundation, McGill University. Thank you to SHRC for funding this conference and for funding the work that went into the white paper. Thank you also to the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences, to FQRSC, and to Universities Canada. They are all here and keen to work with us as we move forward on the kinds of initiatives that we've articulated over the past 2 days. Thank you to the media. This is really fun going public like this. To University Affairs, to the Globe and Mail, to the Walrus, and to CBC Radio that have and are helping us to share our questions, our problems, our challenges, and our opportunities with people outside the university in ways that incentivize our work and that compel us also to speak and think more clearly. Thank you to the universities, the 26 universities from across the country who invested in this work and in this conference, who put in a lot of time, who contributed generously to bring themselves and their students together here to start this work. Thank you to Lee Yetter, who wrote the first SHRC grant application that got us the white paper, who co-wrote the second one that got us here. She's since moved on, but she's still a fellow traveler. Thank you to the team that has worked on this conference, to Sophia Laragatis, to Mia Faircloth, to Sajib Somal, to Casey McCormack, who created the website and has been the genius of social media, and to Eliza Bateman, who is leading from the Faculty of Law and was one of the co-organizers of the student panel that led us off. And thank you, finally, to Sheetal Lodia, who joined iPlay in January and has helped to reshape it in better shape and has led on not only to make all the details possible, but has been a creative force in the planning and execution of this conference. Thank you.
And I think you forgot to thank somebody very important, and that would be yourself, Paul. So I think we should all also acknowledge Paul Yackman. Just a tremendous gathering, such a rich discussion that we've had, and we've had time to laugh and play and express ourselves in different ways. And I know, I'm confident that the work will not end here. In fact, we've got some clear steps forward. My name is Ursula Goebel. I'm Associate Vice President at SHRC, and I'm absolutely delighted to participate in this roundup discussion. We're going to have a very rich, dynamic discussion, so thank you for staying right through. And I'll just quickly introduce our five participants on this closing panel. And Eliza, your name's been recognized a few times, and I'm pleased to introduce Eliza Bateman, who's a PhD student and president of the Grad Law Students Association at McGill. She is a gifted Australian lawyer who left practice to do a PhD, and as Paul noted, she's been closely working with Paul and others to put this conference on. Adjacent just next to Eliza, we have John Newell, who's a PhD student in English from UBC. And he's had a lot of experience, excellent experience, I'm noted, in their new internship program, and he'll be speaking about that, I know. Marie Audette. Marie est doyenne faculté des études supérieures à l'Université Laval. She is also the new president of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies. She's a biochemist, and she noted, and this is noted on the CAG's website, the nature of academic and research work is changing. Almost two-thirds of our doctoral students are making their way in the world of business, government, or the not-for-profit sector, and we need to ensure our students have the best chance of fulfilling their careers. And I know that Marie va parler là-dessus sur ce sujet. Anthony Massey, Tony Massey, is Professor of Sociology and Provost here at McGill. In addition to his work on the sociology of industrialization in the labor market, he's been a leader in pedagogical innovation, and especially in relation to new technologies. And I know that Tony will be speaking about that in terms of the role of the institution and the university in preparing students for their careers. And Noreen Golfman. Noreen has recently been appointed the Provost VP Academic at Memorial University. Noreen is a literary and film scholar. She has previously been the President of the Canadian Federation of Humanities and Social Sciences, as well as a former President of CAGS. So there you have our esteemed group of panelists. Each panelist will speak for approximately 6 minutes, and then we'll engage in a dialogue, and it'll open it up to a fulsome dialogue with the room. So I'll turn it over to Eliza first.
Thank you very much, Ursula, for that very too kind introduction, and I'm very happy to speak to you this afternoon. Being a lawyer, I always break things into points, so I'm going to have 3 points this afternoon. I wanted to start with a little bit of exposition, because there's been a bit of discussion the last 2 days about the usual path of graduate studies, and I'm a bit unusual in many ways, but including my graduate studies experience. And I thought I'd mention it because it might be of help to some people, or at least a point of difference. I finished my Bachelor of Arts and my law degree in 2006 with a major in English and History and Honours in English Literature. We heard a lot in the last panel about impact. I was very concerned about my work making an impact, and I was sure that was going to be as an English academic or an English teacher. I applied to do a literature PhD, and as the day my application went in, the federal government announced that funding for PhD scholarships, university funding for those scholarships, would be cut from 7 to 2 for the incoming cohort. My supervisor and my family actively encouraged me to withdraw my application and go and do law, they said. Don't be a fool without a job, they said. So I took their advice, I took the bar, and I became a lawyer. I then worked in government. I worked for a major Australian law firm, which led to a massive existential crisis. If you're a thoughtful humanities grad and you want to experience genuine pain, go and work for a top-tier law firm. Experience conveyor belt justice and Dickensian workhouse conditions. Finally, after many years of sort of searching for what I wanted to do, I landed a job as legal officer at the Victorian Human Rights Commission, and I came home. I stayed to become their senior lawyer and advisor to the Human Rights Commissioner, and then I ended this stage of my employment as a secondment to the Equality Law Centre at Victoria Legal Aid. What this all taught me was that while I enjoyed being a litigator, and I thought I was good at it, I realised I was much better at advocacy and policy work, and this came directly from my humanities experience. I realise that I love communication, particularly writing. I like talking to people, clients, government, industry. Lots of lawyers don't. I like problem resolution, negotiation and strategising. What I'm saying, I think, is that my humanities skills were going to out themselves at some point, and it happened after all this time of me trying to be a lawyer and realising that I was a square peg in a round hole. At the Human Rights Commission, I finally realised a job where I got to use my legal skills and my humanities skills every day. I became a lawyer who had to respect non-lawyers. We didn't have the resources to pigeonhole people. If there was a job to do, you just did it. In 4 years, I wrote policy reports, I ran strategic litigation, I drafted communication strategies, I handed out rainbow socks at gay clubs at Idaho Week, I wrote speeches for the Human Rights Commissioner, I wrongly printed 4,000 leaflets against racism, and I wrote media releases. What this has led me to realise is that social justice and human rights value the humanities incredibly, and I don't think we've heard a lot about social justice in the last 2 days, but it's a field that they value humanities grads and they value people with PhDs. The reason I'm here is because I was told you will never be a senior manager in social justice if you don't at least have a master's. You need to go back to school. I think that for PhDs and master's students working in the humanities now and being concerned about transferring to a professional environment, if you want to work in human rights and social justice and see an immediate impact from your work, you can do that. They want you. They want smart people, they want creative people, they want people with flexible skill sets. They also want people they don't have to train to have those skill sets because they don't have the money. And I say that knowing that is the case in the not-for-profit world and in government agencies that work in human rights. So I ended up here. I came to the LLM at McGill and I never left. I realised on my first week at McGill Law that I had the opportunity to study legal theory, legal criticism, creative writing and problem solving. Again, for me, a real match between humanities and law. So when they asked me to stay on to do a doctorate, I asked them if they were serious, and then I immediately signed up. What I've learnt in my 2 years of graduate study so far, when you work as a lawyer, your work is all oppositional. You're trained to hunt out weaknesses and shore up your weaknesses with precedent and legislation. You learn to argue for the strongest position, not the most just position or the best win for two parties. And this has implications for how lawyers think, how we reason, and why legal law reform is so slow and poorly understood, and also why we're terrible at parties. Doing my PhD at McGill Law, I'm changing how I think about social justice problem solving and central questions about what is law and where is law. In my doctoral research, I investigate how small religious communities develop sub-legal structures to resolve tensions between groups and individuals. I look at fundamental concepts of community law, what are our moral obligations, and where are our internal ethics? What motivates conformity? What motivates personhood? These are questions that troubled me constantly when I worked as a discrimination lawyer, but then my approach was piecemeal because it had to be. Win the case. Find points of weakness. Use legal argument to demonstrate formal inequality. I knew then, and I'm sure now, that this is not how you achieve equality. We need fundamental social change, and this happens in the deep waters of community norms. We need to think more intelligently about how law affects social justice. We need to look for resolution and holism, not points of weakness. So my time at McGill has taught me how to rethink as a better lawyer, and a lawyer who will go back to the social justice world with more solutions and a more critical approach to problem solving. So I absolutely don't see my time at graduate school as wasted or as a hiatus. I think Jade said it yesterday, when you're here, it's your life, you live it, you can get the most out of what you study. That time in itself has been valuable to me. I'm developing skills, networks, I get to meet incredible people, and I'm spending a great deal of my time thinking and learning about really important questions because I want my work to have an impact, and this is one of the best ways that I can prepare myself to make that impact. The time is for me and for what I love, but I think it's going to be wonderful for my career as well. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much for having me, and thank you for making the effort to get graduate students' points of view in this sort of thing, which I think is really, really important. So I'd like to focus my remarks today from an English perspective. I know that disciplinarity is really uncool at the moment, but I don't want to talk about the humanities generally. just in part because I think conversations around graduate education can sometimes conflate different disciplines. So a bit about me. I was introduced wonderfully, but I'm a PhD student in the co-op program at UBC. And I've had two co-ops so far. The first was a special projects officer at UBC's Faculty of Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies, a position that called on me to think very extensively about graduate education from a variety of perspectives. And the second position, which I'm doing right now, actually, is as a communications person at the Child and Family Research Institute. I think it's worth stressing that neither of these things have anything to do with my research. I research weird fiction, Poe, Lovecraft, horror, the gothic, that kind of thing. These are completely and utterly different. And I actually think this is really important. Because what the co-op has shown me, in essence, is that I have transferable skills, which is sort of a thing we're told all the time. But it's one thing to be told and another thing to experience it firsthand, which I think a lot of graduate students, especially those like me who've been in school since we were 4 and a half, don't recognize. And I've described it before as a bit like a supplicant before Oz, you know, like the Scarecrow or the Tin Man, kind of realizing, oh, I was employable all along. It's not that terrifying outside of the academy. So the co-op program has really emphasized this kind of transferable skills element, which I think is really relevant in discussions of the humanities and graduate education, especially now. Increasingly, though, however, it's been suggested that this focus on skills is inadequate in the face of a faltering academic job market, although, you know, I think there are various reasons to question that. A number of people, a lot of them here, have advanced a kind of public-oriented or applied model of scholarship alongside other recommendations for rethinking the particulars of doctoral education. So to be clear, there are lots and lots and lots, many calls for PhD reform that I unreservedly agree with. For example, pretty much everything Ann Crook said yesterday. I'm a little bit ambivalent about the length of the dissertation. I'll have to think about that one a little bit more. But basically everything else I'm all on board for. I applaud measures to rethink the dissertation as more than a proto-book. I'm enthusiastically in favor of more diverse and interdisciplinary modes of scholarship, for providing humanities PhDs with more technological expertise, for training and communicating to non-academic audiences. And I'd be overjoyed if there was a greater emphasis on teaching, which I think is another thing that's sometimes neglected in these conversations. So where I grow somewhat wary, just a little bit suspicious from my very English perspective, from this very disciplinary perspective, is when the subject of applicability and public orientation comes up, as it does a lot. So to be clear, I'm an enthusiastic supporter of research that looks outward from the academy. I'm actually on a committee that helps make this happen. It's the Public Scholars Initiative at UBC. We fund projects that deal with problems, what have been called real-world problems, which I think is a difficult and problematic way of describing them. However, I feel that scholarship in English specifically holds some special challenges when it comes to a kind of public orientation. And I have doubts, I confess, as to whether a sort of more applied PhD in English is ever going to be viable for a majority or even a significant plurality of English students. So in my opinion, it's worth emphasizing uncompromisingly and repeatedly that English academics, and actually humanities academics generally, already contribute to the public good, both through their teaching and their research. We're all already public scholars. We're all already public intellectuals. So while I have no objection to diversifying the opportunities that English PhD students have, or for that matter, to diversifying the ways they can contribute to the public good, I think we have to be careful lest a kind of zeal for reform leads to a normative or prescriptive critique of English scholarship, sometimes implicit, a critique that denigrates the value of existing research and ignores what are often the genuine interests and desires of students. So while some English PhD students may well be interested in using their scholarly abilities to consider problems outside of the academy in a very sort of obvious and clear and direct way, which is totally wonderful, and again, I'm not bashing that mode of scholarship at all, there are lots and lots of cases within English that those of us studying literature just can't sync up our own research interests with the agendas of governments, businesses and NGOs. As a scholar or a colleague of mine is really fond of saying, there's no Milton Institute and there's no Shelley Incorporated. These don't exist as outside factions that we can neatly ally ourselves with. But that doesn't mean that learning about Shelley and Milton and teaching Shelley and Milton and publishing on Shelley and Milton is unimportant, or for that matter, far less canonical voices than those two. Research steps in to fill knowledge gaps, and a great deal of the current scholarly interest in literary studies now revolves around considering marginalized and non-canonical voices that have been branded unimportant, authors and texts that have been silenced and neglected. And the very nature of this imperative, I think, complicates a sort of scholarly reorientation towards pre-existing social, political, and economic concerns, because by definition they're not always concerned with those voices. So this does not mean for a moment that scholarship can't or shouldn't generate interest in such areas and engage communities, or that publicizing research more than it's currently undertaken is not incredibly valuable, because I think it is. But the implication that the only way forward is for all disciplines as a whole to engender sort of syntheses between the academy and the world outside, I think sort of reifies an old and thoroughly false dichotomy between the university and the real world, and simply fails to grasp a lot of the purposes and processes of literary study. So I don't want to create a straw man out of those arguing for increasing the public orientation of doctoral research. I really don't. Many who've argued for a more applied PhD have been very clear that they don't want a one-size-fits-all style of reform or a sort of top-down prescriptive approach. But what I do want to caution against is falling into a kind of self-flagellating, kind of fallacious way of thinking, this Philistine idea that English scholarship, by focusing on literary text, is somehow self-indulgent, trivial, useless, and inward-looking, unconcerned with the real world, kind of parasitic. This perspective, in my opinion, devalues knowledge, culture, and imagination, and hugely devalues teaching, also pretends that it's somehow not a real thing. So literature, I think, is really quite a real thing in and of itself. Words are real, plays are real, books are real, classrooms are real, the university is part of the real world, you can actually reach out and touch it. Its students, who are part of the public and remain part of it after they leave, go off and take the ideas they glean in the classroom out into other areas. And faculty are members of the public, too, as the clowning exercise clearly demonstrated. So it behooves us to think very carefully, I think, before falling back on a kind of lazy notion of the ivory tower, which wonderfully some of the presentations have discredited, and especially before trying to tether the scholarly passions and practices of English doctoral students to the vicissitudes of market forces, the desires of industry, or the agendas of government. In essence, problems of underemployment should not be confused with the failure on the part of the humanities to contribute to the public good, broadly defined. And again, I want to be clear, this is not an argument for stasis, nor a suggestion that what counts as research should not be reconsidered. And I'm not arguing that the lecture or the monograph are like the only ways English PhDs can contribute to the public good. So I want to conclude just by talking a little bit about master's degrees, if I have time. How long do I have? No, I don't have time. I better stop. All right, so you can talk, you can ask me questions about what I think about master's degrees if you want.
So, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation. Thank you very much. So, I will talk a little bit about what CADS is doing with respect to the sessions during the past 2 days. I will also express non-CADS official opinions, but and we will not be surprised by what CADS is doing. Over the past years, among other topics, the Canadian Association for Graduate Students has promoted discussions and raised issue about the development of skills, a wide array of skills, including professional skills. And back to 2008 with the Tri-Council, CADS has published a paper entitled Professional Skills Development for Graduate Students. It started to bloom, and in the Quebec researcher may know a champion of skills development, Jean-Nicolas, an emeritus from Sherbrooke University, who launched short programs to improve skills needed in research, but going beyond skills needed in research. So since then, almost all universities have developed different form of programs, mostly out of the curriculum, but more and more they are integrating development of a wide array of skills within the curriculum. So more recently, our association has joined the Center for Skills and Post-Secondary Education, an initiative of the Conference Board of Canada. The context is that it is agreed that the traditional forms of teaching and learning, especially at the graduate level, should be examined in the view of the needs of the society and the role the Canada intends to play in the future. It's a question examined by the Center for Skills and Post-Secondary Education, and CAGS is part of this. So for more than 2 years now at the association, our focus was on has been on the PhD, and our last annual meeting at Memorial University last October was rethinking the PhD, and it was challenging, and we heard same issues, question of what we heard during the past 2 days. We must ensure that our programs meet the highest standard of quality, but they also must support new initiatives. So it's quite challenging. We all remember the paper published in The Economist in 2010, and it was nicely entitled "A Disposable Academic: Why Doing a PhD is Often a Waste of Time," and in the context that the only outcome is a career in academia. So it's not a surprise today to tell that the major outcome or the major career path is outside academia. When we ask the question, are we producing too many PhD, it's like asking, are we producing too much knowledge for our need? So it's agreed that the main outcome is not an academia career, but a rather a wide variety of careers, mainly outside academia, rewarding, stimulating careers, not plan B, really great career. And it was so interesting to hear these person having so great career, holding a PhD. And we feel that the PhDs must invade the job market to show how skilled they are. And the PhDs are likely to hire PhD in the organization. Okay, I will maybe go a little bit quicker. Normand Labrie talked about a symposium held in 2013, organized by the Fonds de Recherche du Québec, and a specialist in higher education pedagogy, Nicole Régé-Collet from Switzerland, presented the model in Europe, and it's back to 2002, where they presented the PhD training as more strongly linked to a professional training. They present the PhD student as an apprentice, an emerging researcher, learning the profession of research, implying that the initial training has been oriented toward the profession, changing the curriculum and the supervision model accordingly. For those of us engaged in co-tutelle with France, they know that they have no courses at all, and the students are learning by doing. So according to the model, the training goes also beyond the binomial team student supervisor to include a team of supervisor, including a professional mentor from outside academia. So it influenced the way training is offered in some école doctorale in Europe. So it's a huge challenge. We have talked about rethinking the PhD, but the PhD students are thinking about their PhD, thinking about writing a thesis, defending a thesis, get a job, and it can be quite stressful. So we recognize that it's important stress generated, and CAGS will recognize this year a member institution or a program that has made an important contribution to wellness and balance of its students. It's the CAGS ETS Award to be attributed next October, and the deadline have been extended to the end of June, so if you have good ideas, just contact your graduate school to apply. I will just finish by presenting something that you haven't heard about today, is to engage students in the conversation of Imagine Canada, launched by SHRC. So as we were to define our needs as persons and society, and in order to move forward to the 21st century, we need to know what students think, what are their observations, experiences, and opinion. So CAGS and SHRC joined forces to engage humanities and social science students in some straight talk about opportunity and challenges from social innovation, research, and building our knowledge capital in the context of the SHRC Imagine Canada and the six challengers for the future. And it was a great success. This spring, 23 universities and more than 370 students have taken part to roundtables throughout Canada. And students were not only enthusiastic, but they were also contagious. They were great. Each group has prepared a report, and we are now collecting and reading them. Some students' reporters have been invited to present at ACFAS meeting next week in Rimouski, at the Federation meeting in Ottawa, and also at the CAGS meeting in Calgary. So we will prepare a synthesis multimedia for SHRC, and we will share the report with CAGS member, and this will be part of our 8-month-long Rethinking the PhD project. So thank you.
Thank you. As an academic administrator at McGill, I'm the provost. And for 10 years, I've had this job, and almost every time I start, someone looks at me and says, what is a provost? So for 10 years, I've had a very good job, high paying, and no one knows what I do. Actually, the provost at McGill is the chief academic officer, which means all of the deans of all of the faculties and the dean of the libraries report to me. And at McGill, the provost is also the chief budget officer, which means all of those deans are always very nice to me. We've looked at this. I look at the university from a different perspective than I did when I was a member of the Faculty of Arts. I look at the university and I see a variety of activities that we engage in, but there's one common theme that has been emerging over the last 15 years or so, and that is the one that was just alluded to, that over two-thirds of the people who do PhDs in any given discipline do not wind up in academia directly. So the change in the labor market available for PhDs is really an important change. It affects not only the humanities, but also the STEM disciplines. They had a different adaptation. We in the humanities and social sciences had our PhDs take entirely too long to finish their PhDs. Whereas in the STEM disciplines, they finished relatively quickly, but then went on to do one or even two postdocs before they got a job. So when they did get into academia, if that was their trajectory, they got there at about the same age, and then we just saw those careers develop. The differences that have emerged, however, recently are also important to point out. There are transferable skills, but we're not doing a very good job of helping our graduate students understand what they are. Those transferable skills are the things that we've heard people speak about today, but which we have not packaged in any meaningful way for our own graduate students until very recently. Here at McGill, we've set up in the last 5 years a set of seminars and online courses that are called skill sets. And we run these seminars for our students, we run the programs for our graduate students, so that they can understand across all of the disciplines what those skills that could be transferable really are. And they're numerous and they're important. The second thing we've also noticed is we think of the career trajectory traditionally of PhD students as going into the academy. And we think that the academy consists of three really important things: being collegial, self-governance, doing really important research, and teaching. And we have done virtually nothing in the academy to help people who are going to become future professors to think about pedagogy. And for those people who are not going into teaching, we've done virtually nothing to help them understand that there are really important alternatives. So we've taken a commitment at McGill in the next several years to work with our graduate students, not only to enhance the programs of skill sets that we already have, but to offer creative opportunities or structured opportunities for graduate students in all the disciplines to get additional training. I want to distinguish education and training in a minute. The education that they get is in their disciplines or in the preparation of their dissertations or even working in multidisciplinary teams to get there. The training that we want to provide them come in the form of certificates. We want to give people who think that their career trajectory will take them to the academy a certificate in higher education pedagogy to run simultaneously to the program of study that they're involved in for their doctoral dissertations. The second is for anyone who wants to, we want to offer two types of certificates that are different than that. One is on management. If you're doing a PhD in the humanities, and you might go into one of the fields that we heard about in the panel just before this, you should learn something about the language of business, the timing, the preparation of business plans, the activities engaged in it. So a simple certificate in management will be really, I think, an important part of it. The second, third certificate we'd like to offer is in entrepreneurship, because the social entrepreneurship is really important. And we're seeing that at McGill through another project we have, which is called the Quartier de l'Innovation, which is the urban redevelopment of an area to the south of the university on Peel Street, so just straight south of the university, more or less. And in that area, what we're trying to do is to work not only with the urban redevelopment, but also the economic redevelopment and the dependence that many people have on new ideas and social entrepreneurship as a way of expressing it. So those are the kinds of things that we as academic administrators can help in terms of PhDs, both in the humanities and in the STEM disciplines, get a handle on. Your life doesn't only depend on the academy, but if it does, think about pedagogy, and there, think about the technological tools that you could use to help you become a better teacher. They are tools. And or if you're going to have a career that's outside of the academy, learn something about the language that they use, whether that's entrepreneurship or management. We educate people, and I think it's really important that we draw a distinction between education and training. Education broadens your mind and allows you to develop a sense of confidence in your ability to be analytical, confidence in the content knowledge that you developed. It is a broad-based understanding of the way the world works and how you work in it. Training is much more narrow. And in the old days, that training was the responsibility of the employer who took you on. They expected that a well-educated person could be trained. I run into students all the time who continually themselves like to break down that distinction. And they say, there's no distinction between education and training. When we finish, we should be ready for the labor market. What's the difference between education and training? I use an analogy. When you were students in high school, your parents were probably very happy that you had sex education classes. But if we turned them into sex training classes, they might not be as enthusiastic. One last point. I'm trained as a demographer, which means I like numbers and I count a lot of things. But my recollection of my own undergraduate education, which was at a liberal arts college, never goes back to what I majored in. It goes back to the interdisciplinary humanities courses that we all had to take in a core curriculum. I'm going to just name the three of them. The first one, and I still remember the names, the first one was philosophy, religion, and drama. And the second one, and has a very long title, was music, poetry, and the visual arts from the dawn of history to the present day. And the third one was values and institutions, which had a bit of social science in it, in a changing world. Those courses were decisive for me because they helped me to understand the world from a perspective that I still have the importance of humanities and humanistic disciplines. I launched a challenge in my last second term as provost at McGill to both the STEM disciplines and the humanities to come up with new ideas and exciting programs that could bring together people across different disciplines. We brought together in the sciences a new program called the Integrated Program in Neuroscience, which over the last 5 years has become McGill's single largest PhD program. It's a neuroscience program that cuts across 7 different faculties, including the Faculty of Arts with the Department of Linguistics, Educational Psychology, Music. We have a very large group, and the Basic Sciences, Medical Science, and Engineering. The second is the one we have here today, the sponsor for this symposium, which is iPlay, which was an idea that came from Paul Yakin through a challenge that was launched that there are ways of having people in the humanities think differently about what they're doing, including graduate education. So I'm glad that we had a chance to see it come to fruition today. Thank you.
Okay, finally, I want to thank you all for coming, and sure, you're leaving right now. Yeah, great. Yeah. Yeah, you're afraid. I want to thank Paul and Lee and Sheeta and everybody else for this wonderful conference. Just take the opportunity as the last speaker to say that. It's been a rich 2 days of conversation. I'm tired. You're probably tired. I'm just glad I'm speaking because I'm going to keep myself up for a minute. I'm also grateful, just to echo what other people have said about the student presence here, has been critical to the rigor, I think, and robustness and enthusiasm of the conversation, keeping us on our toes, to put it mildly. And I've been really grateful to be here with so many longstanding friends and colleagues, especially since I've first wandered the spaces of McGill many, many years ago as an undergraduate, where my first English course in an honors English program was Sergei Eisenstein and William Blake. And I would say there is a logical line of continuity between that course and the interdisciplinary nature of that course, which scared the hell out of me and my peers, to this moment and everything I'm about to say following. I also just want to put a word in of thanks to all the tweeters, because there's been a really robust field of tweets generating lots of critical commentary in a kind of witty opposition to some of the boosterism that we've seen here. So if you don't tweet, I feel sorry for you, and I'm mildly contemptuous if you don't, but I'd say you're missing out on a whole other conversation that has been going on in this room. So let me say that I think the most rewarding part of the experience has been with like-minded colleagues and students who recognize we need to make change. And as humanists, we're pretty good at reflecting on ourselves and understanding what the barriers and challenges are to appreciating the value of what we do. But perhaps we may remain less certain about how to affect change. And the question of where do you start, has kept coming up. Yesterday, Chad Gaffield boasted about our capacity to understand the complexity of human beings and how humans deal with change. Maybe, you know, but why is it that our institutions, our arts and humanities faculties in particular, are so reluctant to change or to transform themselves? In my view, we are stubbornly more conservative and resistant to change than almost every other group on campus, even while we teach and preach the value of transformative experience. It's a contradiction devoutly to be abolished, I should think. So arguably, one of the subtly recurring themes of the last 2 days has been the reluctance of many of our colleagues, no one here, of course, to see things as we have been seeing them here. Students and, oddly, administrators, deans of graduate studies, the faculties of arts, vice presidents, provosts, increasingly agree that we cannot and should not rest with the status quo, that the humanities must look outward and engage more fruitfully with the wider world and vice versa, that we should stop being defensive about what we do but focus on the benefits of our activities, that we should practice, not just promote, diversity, that we need to be more transparent and accountable, that we should embrace our interdisciplinary inclinations and foster instead of stifle them, that we need to imagine new ways of delivering our programs, consider shortening the dissertation, relax our tired and some ways distracting dependence on the published monograph, that we need to be honest with ourselves and stress the transferable skills a humanities degree provides to prepare students for a successful life beyond the academy, and so on. So the question is how to inspire others once we all leave here, others to let go of older models of program delivery and everything else that we've been talking about here. How to convince our peers, faculty members to look forward, not backward, to increasingly ineffectual frameworks of learning. How to inspire those willfully resistant faculty colleagues to abandon the hollow myth that a life of work beyond the academy is somehow a mark of failure. How to stop trying to create mini-me clones of ourselves or whatever ideal of ourselves we think we have become. I have a dream. Actually, it's not an original dream, but of course I'm a humanities scholar and I know how contested originality is. But I do have a dream. The dream is inspired by the leadership and vision of the president of Arizona State University, Michael Crow. I don't know if you've ever encountered Michael Crow. He is very present on YouTube. He's a very testosterone-y kind of guy, but he's got a lot of charisma and he has a vision that's rather provocative. Crow, in fact, and his colleague William Dabers have just published a book called Designing the New American University. I highly recommend it. Often outrageous and almost always provocative, Crow has helped to transform a large state public university into a leading research engine, stressing inclusiveness, diversity, public engagement, and wide public access. He's done this in part by urging the dissolution of the very foundational structure of our arts and humanities faculties, departments. His view is that universities do not structure their activities to answer society's big questions and meet its expectations. He's created, just for example, and not unlike your example, Tony, a research and teaching unit called Science and the Imagination, where he brings poets together with neuroscientists and biomedical people, and it's surged in popularity. He has been urging the cross-fertilization of areas of study, mixing humanities scholars up with scientists and engineers, and vice versa, with biomedical researchers and with business admin professionals. He has asked us to unbelieve much of what we generally regard as true in the academy. From my new vantage point in the provost's office, a huge barrier to change on our campuses is the discipline-defining departmental structure. It is a dated model of learning and research. It inhibits interdisciplinarity and collaborative research potential. It encourages affiliations with small cells, what we often call silos, of activity. It is hidebound and resistant to change. It fights for faculty positions, sets itself up against other silos in its own faculty. It jealously guards its administrative territory and the budget that attends to it. And it reinforces a narrow, self-important notion of learning itself. Because departments are, in effect, defined by their disciplinary titles, they stream students into their programs and actively discourage broader collaborative supervisory or research committees, with exceptions, of course. They discourage cross-appointments and innovative ways of working across campus. It is, and I believe this with Michael Crow, a tired 19th century model of learning that we simply cannot seem to reinvent. Why do we stick with it when we need to be opening ourselves up to much more innovative structures that foster interdisciplinarity or, to use Chad's own favorite phrase, discipline-based interdisciplinarity, I don't know what the hell that is, but anyway, and more fluid movement across the disciplines? Have you ever tried to get a department in the humanities to join with another? Or to you ever try that? Or transform itself into a broader administrative structure? You'd think Armageddon was being proposed. I urge us in these waning moments of this wonderful two-day conversation to think much more boldly about transforming ourselves. And I'm a little surprised that the subject hasn't even come up as we've talked about change and transformation in the programs, not in the departments. I hope we're not just going to be giving lip service to or tweaking some modest changes to those programs. I do believe we need to be thinking about how best to conjoin our activities, developing clusters of activity and thought, marrying the humanities to a much broader base of learning. I know there are some of you sitting there thinking, that bitch is crazy. It ain't gonna happen. Okay, you're thinking, what about our governance practices, our traditional affiliation, our ways of doing business, our professional societies, etc.? Well, I'm asking all of us to try to think way, way outside those boxes, the departmental box, to be bold and innovative and transformative and get behind leading change following this conference in our humanities structures. The conference began with Casey saying rather understatedly, things are a bit bleak. We then moved, I think it's fair to say, towards a tacit consensus about who we are and what we have to do to move forward to affect change, using or drawing on or inventing or imagining a 21st century model of learning and research, inching ourselves out of the bleakness, out of exploitative labor conditions, out of tired ways of learning. But I'm recommending again that we move even further in our thinking and consider reinventing the very structures we inhabit completely. It's hard to let go, but as Chad pointed out, we have been talking about ourselves like this for a few decades now. So let's shake it up. Thank you.
Noreen, when we were thinking about the order of things, Noreen says, I think I should go last. Now we know why. Of course, I had a set of questions, but I'm just wondering that in the interest of time, if we want to open it up right away. And we've had some just absolutely terrific thoughts expressed by all of our panelists. There's a few themes, though, that are clear to me that have come through in the last 2 days and that have also emerged here in our discussion. And maybe I'll just throw those themes out and we can have a conversation as it relates to specific questions and Q's and A's. And one is clearly the issue of values and what is valued. What is valued by the academy? What is of value to society? What is of value to our graduate students? And then how is that value measured? So I would welcome some discussion around that. What was interesting, and Mehdi made reference to the round tables, there was a round table with graduate students just down the street at Concordia around the future challenge areas and focusing on what knowledge does Canada need to for the future. And it was primarily comprised of graduate students in the humanities. And I'm just going to do one quote that speaks to this issue of value and how graduate students perceive what they think are other values in terms of the work that they do. A quote, so much of what we do in all of our disciplines is about focus, really in-depth, effortful study. Every claim, every statement we make has to be justified, has to be grounded in the literature, in the data. But here is a chance to draw from our experiences, from our research, from our expertise, and to play with ideas and think about our future. So why did it take a specific activity to bring students together to have that occasion? For graduate students to take that moment to share ideas, leverage their experience, their ideas, their research. And that speaks to the issue, to one of the remarks yesterday, in terms of are we students or are we emerging scholars? Are we junior researchers? How is our work valued? So value, if we can have a chat about that. And then the issue of engagement. It was interesting. There was a lot of discussion about, and John referenced, you know, that public engagement and public humanities, I'm not dissing it, but there is an inherent issue with regards to perhaps some of the disciplines, in English in particular. And so the whole issue of engagement, Kyle earlier talked about, you know, I didn't let my supervisors know until after my dissertation that I got, you know, hired as the managing editor of The Walrus. I didn't even know that that work would be celebrated because it was external to the Academy. So the whole issue of engagement. I'm just going to leave it there within the context of values and open it up to the floor right away. We only have half an hour. Let's keep this dynamic conversation going. Josh.
Thanks, Jonathan, for thanking the conference organizers for allowing us to participate. I think that's absolutely important. Thank you for doing that. Though I've been very outspoken on behalf of the public humanities, as though I've drank the Kool-Aid in some fanatical crusader-like way, I do share your ambivalence towards, or maybe I'll call it psychic struggle, between reverence to the way that we do our traditional English learning and the irreverence that we need to show towards public engagement. Mm-hmm. Here's where I have a tension, which will lead to my question. What I find is that when people articulate their suspicion towards the public humanities or towards more public engagement, they tend to do so as though they're from a minority position. So a faculty member who's very powerful will say, well, excuse me for saying this, but I want to say that I want to defend what we've been doing as though it's under threat. So for the majority, poses itself as though it's in the minority. And one of the things that I find that's behind this attitude is that there's an either-or that's being set up.
Yes.
So that if I go hard on the public humanities as a student, I'm threatening somebody's dominant position.
Yeah.
When in fact, for me, I think it's not either-or, it's and both. I can help you by doing this work in your department that you don't want to do, so that the Miltonist can be a Miltonist. So that a Shakespearean can be a Shakespearean, which isn't to exclude the Miltonists and Shakespeareans from also being public scholars, but right now there are a lot of Miltonists and whatever person it is, whatever philosophic position, who are preventing me from being a citizen scholar. So here is my question for you, recognizing that we share a psychic ambivalence. When I see public scholarship done poorly, I think of Stanley Fish, the bake sales and Renaissance festivals, and I think, oh God, they're giving this looks bad on us. What would be the right balance? What is it, an either or? Is it an and both for you? How would you ease your psychic struggle over this, recognizing that you have sympathy for both sides?
Yeah, so thank you so much, Josh. I must admit, I have been dreading your inevitable question. Like, very early in the conference, I was like, this is someone who I'm going to have some sort of interaction with. And I was deeply, but you've actually reassured me, because I was considering starting my talk with something along the lines of, I want to talk about the danger of either-or thinking, which is, and I think you've got it exactly right. Like, I'm not in favor of, like, dissing public scholarship or scholarship that deals with problems outside the academy or suggesting that it's not needed or that it shouldn't be encouraged or funded. I'm absolutely all for it. As for the balance between, and I take your point that kind of frees up certain people to talk about, you know, things that might be, you know, some sort of knowledge for its own sake kind of a scholarship. I think that's actually a really interesting point. As for the specific balance, that's really interesting. Like, I haven't thought about, here's the percentage or something like that. And I think a lot of people individuals don't have to be either or either. So, like, I could have a project that was very much like, oh, I'm going to be writing a book about Oscar Wilde and aesthetic theory and, you know, social practices and history and all sorts of very traditional scholarly things. And then the next year I could be, you know, partnering with a community or with an organization or something like that that interests me as well. So I don't think it needs to be either or, either for individual researchers or for, you know, the academy as a whole. Exactly the opposite for me. I want to resist all false dichotomies, pretty much, or suggestions that we need to overhaul the whole thing. The only thing that I was concerned with, I guess that this speaks to my psychic struggle, is that when you start to think through the call for public scholarship, it's not that the call is wrong or that there's something wrong-headed about it. It's that I sometimes detect lurking in the background the possibility of a slippage into those very dichotomies between real world and the academy, and the idea that the public somehow doesn't already permeate the academy in lots of really important ways. And that's kind of what I'm hesitant about. But I completely take your point that this is a sort of hat trick that gets pulled by conservative members of the academy who are, you know, will suddenly act all beleaguered as if they don't have, you know, as if this traditional momentum hasn't been favoring them all along, which I think is, you know, disingenuous at best, yeah.
Can we have a comment up there?
Yeah, thank you. Anthony Parry, I was here at McGill for about 250 years, and last year left and went to UBC, which was, by the way, described to me as a university surrounded on three sides by water and one side by reality. So that one of the things I think that we're trying to do is how do we get through that reality? And, of course, there's a forest, actually, between the campus and reality. But I was while I was here, I served two terms as a department chair. And I am a department head at UBC. You might know where this is going, Noreen. I'm coming to you because I think I disagree with you that the cause of some of that impermeability and that kind of reification of practice is the department structure. I think department structure is actually a symptom itself of a variety of other things, including working workload distribution, for example, and assessment practices, and the three-credit package of the course. I mean, I've had colleagues who have been cross-appointed, and they hated it because they had two department meetings to go to. They had twice as many committees to sit on. So I think that there might be a variety of structures in the university itself, a variety of factors and phenomena that create the department impermeability, and that I think block many of the things that we're talking about today. So you can't actually go and do some kind of internship outside the university because we don't know how to assess that. We don't know how to give marks. You can't hand in a documentary because nobody can score that. We know how to score texts. That's what we were trained to do, and that's what we're going to keep doing, damn it. And I just wonder if it's a challenge to you. Is it the case that the departments, and I would love to have some of that kind of interdisciplinary stuff that you're talking about, but is it the case that it's the departments that block that possibility, or are there other structures and dynamics at work that are doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think they're separate. I think they're all related. And I fully believe that workload assignments, especially enshrined in our collective agreements, I was vice president of our faculty bargaining association and helped create the very language that excluded interdisciplinarity. So I come out the other side realizing, in particular as a dean of grad studies for 6 years, how inhibiting that our collective agreements are, because the word interdisciplinarity does not appear once in our collective agreement. So all workload assignments are department-based. So I totally agree with you, and I had 6 minutes. I was sort of throwing out the challenge. I'm also wanted to use all of you as a kind of test case, because I'm new in the job, and I don't want to be like out of the job in a year the way every other provost in this country now is. So I'm kind of teasing out a conversation here that I need to help lead, and I want to get people on side and engaging in this without feeling threatened by it. But I totally agree with you. It's not either or. It's part of a whole system of assessment that departments, I think, help to reinforce.
Okay, three hands. We got Paul. We got somebody up there. Go ahead.
Is it me or Paul?
Thank you. This is wonderful.
You're next.
Do we have three Pauls? That often happens. I'll be quick. I want to talk about mobility, movement, in response to John's idea of putting aside those false dichotomies. That seems exactly right. It's not against disciplinarity. It's about people who are in disciplines being confident enough to move and work with people in other disciplines. And boy, can you ever learn from that. including a great deal about your own discipline. And that is inhibited by departmental structures. There's no question about it. Universities are very, very good at attracting extremely talented people and then keeping them away from each other for their whole careers. And one of the things that we've discovered at iPlay is that people from different faculties really like to work together and teach together, and they gain immeasurably from it, and their whole sense of the space of the university changes and opens up. But I was chair of a department for 6 years, and I fought like a beast for the department, and I did that because that was my responsibility. And I was right to do that because there was a department. As soon as you have the structure, you have an ethical investment in protecting that structure. So I don't exactly know how you do this in a way that doesn't leave bodies all over the place, but it's a really interesting idea.
Okay, up at the top.
So this is also a response to Noreen Goffman. So I'm a PhD student in musicology, and I have so much sympathy with what you've been saying, that I feel, especially in music, we have our own faculty. So I feel like with my work being so engaged with philosophy and literature studies, so penned in musicology. So in some ways, I respond really excitedly to what you say, but I'm also worried that interdisciplinarity isn't possible without disciplines. And, you know, so that's something I've learned over the years of my initial frustration with being in music faculty and then realizing that all that specific training that they made me do that I kind of didn't want to do, and that gives me a unique voice when I talk to philosophers. I have something different to say than what they have to say. So how do we get this disciplinary-based training if we don't have departments? So it's a practical question.
Well, I was with you until the question, because I'm not sure you need departments to have the discipline-based training. You can go deep without a department. But we haven't been able to imagine structures that allow for more fluidity while preserving the deep knowledge that we want or seek in the areas that we're pursuing. We haven't done it. As I suggested, I mean, there are few people out there, very few, trying to reimagine this and trying to invent new ways, including Arizona State. I'm not saying it's a utopia by any stretch, and some people are calling it a factory of interdisciplinarity, but I'm sometimes astonished at how limited we are in our thinking through some of the challenges we've been talking about here. I don't have an answer to how, but we have to think about new structures together, and I think it would help students too, and foster the kind of openness that we're talking here in a kind of ideal way that we want at our universities. So we got to blow up those structures, but put something in their place, or maybe some hybrid version. I don't know, but it's a big challenge. But I'm saying we should go big or go home about this stuff.
Thanks. Okay, next.
There is an element. Sorry.
Where are we?
I'm right here. I just wanted to respond to that. One of the things that we've seen at McGill over the last 10 years is that we've got about 33% of all of our professors in the Faculty of Medicine are joint appointed in more than one department. In some cases, it's three or four departments. The other thing is that whatever the discipline of your PhD was, it doesn't matter to getting appointed in another department. So they've learned something that we might be able to transfer to the social sciences and humanities, which is it's the area of your research and your ability to transmit knowledge to students, mostly, in their case, graduate students, the importance of the research they do. And they create mechanisms like institutes, which have to have more than one department or faculty involved in order to get established and to have a funding base. So interdisciplinarity is not new. It's been around, and it's been tried in the academy in different areas. It's somewhat new to what we talked about here, but not that new either. There have always been attempts at interdisciplinarity. So I think it's possible to re-envisage that, and it may not need to be blown up completely, but certainly pushed and modified.
So I'm the product of an interdisciplinary BA program at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst called the Bachelor's Degree with Individual Concentration. My party trick is I have the longest BA title. It started actually in the 1970s, and we're down the street from Hampshire College, which I'm sure, I don't know how many of you know, is entirely interdisciplinary. So, and Hampshire has all kinds of issues. They have a higher attrition rate. And so I wanted to, I now realize also why Noreen chose the students she did, because we are going to inherently be her cheerleaders. And I think that this is a program that can work. I actually chose to go to MUN because I could get this is actually my first traditional degree. My other two were interdisciplinary. But I could do it in a context that would allow me to be interdisciplinary. And I don't feel that, and I felt a pressure to get a traditional degree because I've noticed is that it's very hard for us to explain to people when we do interdisciplinary stuff to the rest of the world. And I want to say also, and I think Eliza sort of mentioned this sort of backhandedly, that professional schools like my museum studies program or the law program that she's in do this incredibly well. And they allow you to work in multiple fields, and they seem to have to some degree figured it out of pure force. The museum studies departments all have to be cross-disciplinary, and the same is true to some extent in archives and law and as was mentioned, in other professional programs. So I think it's both not as new as we think, and I think I don't know how many people have been produced by BDIC, but there are an awful lot of us sneaking around in back rooms, and a lot of us wound up in traditional academic posts or doing traditional degrees later on. So I think there is a structure, and there is also the ability to go deep, and that you can work within multiple departments. I don't feel like I ever lost something other than a social life to some extent by not being in a department. But I also made friends in fields that were much more useful to me, like labor studies, who I wouldn't have met if I had gone a traditional route as a BA in history or a BA in American studies.
I don't know if you wanted a response to or anything said about that, Emma, but I just actually was thinking when the lady intervened about musicology. McGill Law has a really, I know a lot of people know this, but the process that McGill Law has gone on in the last 15 years to change the structure of the faculty and also to create more interdisciplinary work, to work with iPlay, but also to create sort of very different, I guess, schools or initiatives within the law school. So I have nothing in common with anyone who's working in air and space law. And their institute is world renowned, and they are incredibly specialised, and they work in Montreal, and I never see them. Unless we're doing something that actually is about that has an interdisciplinary focus, and then they're incredibly valuable, and we have forums and we get together and we share ideas, and I learn a huge amount. I don't think it's definitely not been the death of McGill Law School. I think the McGill model is a really interesting model. The students love it, and I learn more sometimes. I've learnt more outside the classroom in the last 2 years, I think, than I learnt in it, in some way, and that's because of the strength of the interdisciplinary connections.
Okay, we've got a few more questions. I'm just going to let everyone. When we've got 5 minutes left, I'm going to ask our panelists, but also in the room, at an occasion where we can meet each other again in 1 year, so history doesn't repeat itself by 30 years, 1 year from now, where would you like us to see advancement? Be it structures, be it training, 1 year from now, if we're having this conversation, what has changed in terms of what you would like to see change? So keep that in mind. So we've got right here.
So what's very interesting about this conversation is that I feel that we are in a very particular position as universities that train graduate students. That is, I met with all the deans of arts, as one does every year, and what I discovered was that the deans in small colleges have dealt with this interdisciplinary problem because they have to, that they have created programs that are way more interesting and innovative than the big research universities, because the big research universities say, but we are the holders of disciplines. We are the trainers of graduate students, and that actually limits our ability to be creative, to be outward facing. Those smaller colleges are doing work in public in ways that we are not. And I think that's quite peculiar, that we cannot do the creative work because we're training the next generation, who then can't do the creative work either because we haven't trained them. It's a sort of pernicious circle. So I do think that this is an instance where we can learn something from some of those smaller colleges But I mean, Noreen, as you talked, I thought, how do we do that? I feel beaten down by even trying to join together an office staff. That's been 3 years of hell, let alone try to put disciplines together.
Testing. So I am an enormous believer in forcing functions as someone who gets up in a room full of academics and says, put a 5-year hard stop on a PhD. So here's what I would say about how to reimagine the departmental structure. I'm also an enormous believer in that budgets are a reflection of values. And I believe that the departmental structure that we now have may have grown intellectually out of the 19th century, but in the early 21st century, it's a reflection of funding and budgets. And because, you know, and I could hear that in what Paul said about how he worked to defend his department. And so I think if we're going to reimagine departments, one of the pragmatic things we're going to have to do is reimagine what the unit of funding is. That is, does it go with the head of the individual teaching individual? Does it go with the kind of courses we offer that we need to staff a certain number of them? But I think it's the way we're thinking about the units we're funding currently, and I realize this is not where this came from intellectually, but it's the way we're thinking of how we're funding that's constraining our brains. What I would recommend is imagining a number of different sources of funding and organizations of funding. I think that would help us. I think that exercise would help us.
So, any reaction to that?
You can follow. I'll just say that I'm not surprisingly leading a big budget discussion at the university now, and I've got the deans trying to collaborate with each other on a new funding model for their units. And this is, of course, behind it, everything I'm talking about. And they're banging their heads together. I said, give me three models. Give me something by June. So, you know, maybe next year I'll tell you what they came up with. But I've been forcing them, to use your verb, to collaborate or come up with something ideal that's based on a more credible and creditable and value-based and consensual budget model. It's hard. It's really hard because our brains aren't wired that way. We're not trained to think that way, but that's where we are right now.
There have been a lot of experiments with activity-based budgeting at universities where differential fees are charged or differential grants come in and the money follows the student. So at McGill, we actually have a model in which the funding follows the student by the teaching. So the unit that does the teaching gets the credit for the student, not the department in which they're enrolled. And that works. For example, we have 85% of our undergraduate students who do a degree in psychology actually do a BA, but the department is in science, and so science gets all the credit for the teaching of the psychology students. And that allows the budgeting to flow a bit to the student. But we're funded by a government, in case you hadn't noticed. It's a publicly underfunded institution. And one of the things that happens there is that governments give differential grants in Quebec for different disciplines. So all of us, all of you in this room, are a one, right? The lowest possible weight. In Quebec, the assumption is made that if you teach a student in an English class, you need 100 of them to be equal to 25 students that you educate in plant science, right? So 4-to-1 ratio in funding, and then it goes up by level and discipline. So the funding models, if we were to fund the university the way the government funds us as a university, we would have to close departments and whole faculties. Instead, we take the money that they give us, and we have an internal model for redistributing it that actually recognizes that some faculties need to be internally subsidized. We have a great music faculty. We have a great law faculty. If we funded those two faculties the way the government of Quebec funds McGill, we wouldn't have those faculties.
We have coming up there. And
hi. It's probably my last chance to ask this question, but this has been an incredible 2 days here in Canada, and I'm taking what I'm learning here back to the States and back to the MLA in New York, and I really think they need to do a similar national conference in the U.S. about reforming graduate education and bring in lots of graduate deans and provosts and also graduate students to talk about graduate education and the humanities. I did hear one sort of negative note at some point in the world the last 2 days, and I wrote it down, and it was, quote unquote, if Toronto doesn't get behind this, it's not going anywhere. All right. I don't remember who said it, but it did worry me, and I thought, well, wait a minute, if Harvard doesn't get behind this, is it not going to go anywhere in the States? But then I remembered ASU, right? And I just wonder what you think about that model, a sort of upstart, formerly very, you know, low-level state university, very poor funding, has suddenly become a leader, you know, across the nation in innovation. Is that a model that can work here?
Well, that's what I'm suggesting. Take a look at it. It's still an experiment. I think it went from 50,000 to 77,000 students, and it's went, as you say, from being in the swamp of the ratings to the top 10 or something in the U.S. It's just astonishing transformation. And in less than 10 years, I might add. Less than 10 years. So, you know, things can be done quickly, but it takes, as people are tweeting, trust and a willingness to do that and a real embrace of change. And you got to lead that. People have to buy into that, right? But I definitely think it's worth looking at, and that's what I'm suggesting that we do.
I think it's worth looking at, but I hope that no one retweets it's in the top 10.
Oh, in the States.
Not even in the States. No. It's an interesting model. It's something that deserves being looked at. It's a very innovative approach to trying to do things. A lot of internal resistance goes on at ASU as well. It's not that everyone is bought in, or what's the expression, drank the Kool-Aid. They haven't all gone that way. Its state funding is still very dependent. It's still very dependent on the state, so it has some problems for internal funding, but it's worth looking at. And it has been very innovative in terms of the approaches that have been taken. It gets a lot, it's certainly in the top 10 in terms of number of lines of print that have been written about it.
Okay, so we have Fred, and then we have Bob, and then we had one comment here. Fred's got the mic. Oh, did you want to say anything more? Yeah.
When I get excited / angry, my English is less precise, so I'll try to slow down and gather my thoughts. I think it'd be sad if we ended this. I think these are important questions that were asked about what kind of structures inhibit or foster change, although I deeply, very strongly, and completely disagree with what was proposed. But that's another discussion. But I'm just not convinced that, you know, a structure itself would make humanities more relevant or less relevant. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that these structures don't have effects, but my guess is you could get rid of all departments and create, you know, smart departments, you know, whatever you want to call them. You would have some of the same challenges and some of the same opportunities, right? What I want us to remember is that even though there is a selection effect and we're all interested and committed to a certain degree of change, and we've been pointing out that some of our colleagues who are not here are maybe more resistant to change, I mean, even those colleagues who are more resistant to change are changing knowledge in ways that we can't imagine, right? So it's not, the question is not so much, it's really about motivating them or giving them incentives to see how the change that they're providing is relevant to more than a small community that they've imagined. I don't know if that's too abstract, but I'm more optimistic, basically, about existing structures to provide the change we want at zero cost, right? I just think, honestly, obviously there are some budgetary constraints about what type of degrees will pass and those that won't, but just in terms of the question that we were asked about making humanities PhDs, you know, more, let's say, relevant to different stakeholders, we could do it at zero budget change. We could do it at 15% budget reduction, at 15% budget increase, right? But there's a question about colleagues who are already doing cool stuff and they don't believe what they're doing is cool to anybody else than their small community, how do we convince them to change? And frankly, that's not a structural. I'm not saying we should go one individual to the next, but what can we do about either faculty integration, you know, new faculty that's recruited, or, you know, incentives to motivate colleagues there to attend free pizza where we talk to them about this, or beer. You know, beer usually works better than pizza, or wine, you know, depending on the age group. But so, yes, there is, we do need beer money. Okay, we'll need some beer money. But frankly, I'll just end with this. Sorry to editorialize. Again, it's because I'm excited and slightly, excited. I'll just say excited. It's positive. One thing that I'll do within the year, you asked one thing we could do within the year, is I'll ask my colleagues, or when I'm asked to assess a file, if somebody tells me, this was raised by Leslie yesterday, if somebody gives me a file to evaluate for promotion or for grants or whatever, I'll gently say, I will not consider placement record of your PhD students unless you tell me what your students who aren't faculty are doing as well. So it's up to you. You know, if you want to use your placement record, do so. You should be proud. I mean, I'm using my placement record. But you have to list what your students who are not faculty now, what they're doing. Otherwise, you can't use your placement record. And this, I'll do that for websites. You know, if a department is saying, oh, we're so good because we've placed someone, you know, at UBC or Calgary, said, I'm not going to care unless you tell me what your other students are doing. This costs nothing, and I'm going to start doing it for tomorrow and not just for a year. And I'm not saying it's going to solve everything, but it's a very small cultural shift that can easily change. You know, the metric of success is not just your faculty placement record. That's it. And it's cheap, and we can keep departments and disciplines because they rock.
So we're going to take the next two comments and then leave the last few minutes to the panel. Okay, Bob?
Hello. I'm Bob Gibbs from the University of Toronto. I wanted to speak to that question briefly, but I also wanted to speak to the larger question. So there were more people from the University of Toronto at this conference than any university except McGill. There were graduate students, faculty, and administrators. And I can't tell you that we loved the white paper when we got it, but we've been meeting and talking about it for months. There's been a real interest. This is a report to all of you. There's a document on the website, our response to it. And it's actually a pretty radical response. I'm glad that you're all looking to us and worried about whether we're going to do the job, but the good news is we're here, we're in, and we really do want to see this change. The graduate students are driving it very heavily at the U of T. They did it so well they walked out on strike. And the strike was really much more about these issues than it was about pay. So there is a really... there is a real interest there, and I think part of it is we had to persuade some people, but we had to say, look, this is a national conversation. We have to be in it and not just sitting back. So that's the first thing. The second thing, which I think is more important, is as interesting, and I disagree with the philosopher because I'm a philosopher, that's our job, as interesting as the question about departments is, I think the really important questions to leave this meeting with are the ones that some of the ones which came up early and come up consistently, and that's very much about the relationship between the university and what is normally called its outside. I'm in favor of all dichotomies, false ones, true ones, whatever. but it does seem to me that those relations are not totally fictitious. The distinction and the question of how to listen and learn from what's going on outside the university and how to bring that into the university and create a circulation of knowledge is really a key issue. And it's really exciting to have seen so many people talk about that here in so many different ways. And it should irrigate the university as well as benefit society. Last thing I'll say, at the very beginning of the report back, we presented to you three action items, two of which actually are asking you to participate in something over the next year. I know the whole conference has not been about public humanities. There have been a lot of issues about graduate education. But on the public humanities, we've got some action items about pooling our information through a website and developing some sort of toolkit which we can use to go around and try to initiate some of the changes in local cultures. So if I had my wish, a year from now, we'd have a very difficult and challenging report back on those enterprises because we'd have found out that some places we could do it and some places we couldn't. And that itself would be really valuable for us. Thank you.
I know I'm standing between a beer and a wine and the summary of our panel, but I know there was one last comment that you had had very quickly, and then last word goes to our panelists about a year from now.
I'll make it very quick because this person actually started to answer the question that I had or the interest that I had. And following up perhaps on what Emma suggested, where we're brought up here as Newfoundland cheerleaders. I know we're an odd lot perhaps. But when you talk about, I just from a personal experience, I've had difficulty getting through the departments and et cetera and getting them to work on the team that I had envisioned initially, at least. And that's not to say that who I have now is not, you know, just some second best, but I wonder at the student lobby that was brought up right at the beginning from Sarah, and I'm hoping that perhaps in answer to where would you like to be, we've suggested that students, I think, would like to possibly be at a situation where there is some more of a coalesced group that is perhaps national and circumvents departments and the islands of the universities here versus there. And I wonder maybe if that lobby does exist in the minds perhaps of the faculty people and the administrators, and whether the provosts, the one who brought us as cheerleaders and the one perhaps who's more urban and of a larger university than our place where an island in a department makes such a difference. Does the student voice exist? Can that student voice exist? Is that lobby there?
That's a great point to turn to in terms of the student voice. So let's just turn to our students on the panel first, maybe in response to that quickly, and then summarize. Where would you like to see us a year from now?
Oh, thank you, and thanks, Stephen, for that question. I know that Casey and I have been talking a lot in the last couple of days about where the students who have been here for this conference would like to be in a year. What we want to commit to is to develop a student network and develop, an awareness of public humanities issues, but also issues on campus. We want to discuss things like part-time work, TA ships, funding issues. We came to this conference with, our buzzwords being transparency and accountability, and that's what we would like to sort of build as a coalition of students, whether that's probably done virtually because we are from across the country. We want to see that coalition build, and we want that to be a conversation that continues. If possible, we'd like to continue that conversation with alumni as well, because it's been raised a couple of times that we have skills and we want professional jobs. Some of us do. The best way to do that is to continue having conversations with people who have been successful doing that. So we're going to fight as hard as we can to keep that conversation going, and hopefully that will also address some of the other needs that we've discussed about data retention, about where people are, what they're doing, and how they can give back to the university, and how maybe we can help them reconnect with the university. So I'm getting lots of nods from Casey. I hope I've hit everything correctly. But, yeah, that would be, a roll-up of where we would like this to be in a year.
Okay. Yeah, I would echo all of that. I mean, to me, where I would like to be in a year, or where I think graduate students would like to be in a year, is reassured and more confident in themselves. I would like graduate students to recognize their own value far, far more than they do. It's often been said by people in my department that like graduate school is sort of infantilizing in a sense, you know, because you arrive and you look up to your supervisor who, you know, rewards or punishes you based on your behavior, and you kind of learn at their feet. But actually, I think a big revelation for graduate students is to recognize the abilities they already have by dint of being there and through their research. And reaching out to people like alumni and creating a network and recognizing that value through those people who have gone on in non-academic jobs and been incredibly happy and fulfilled is like a vital part of that. So I would sort of hope that graduate students just stop panicking quite so much a year from now. Sort of Douglas Adams, don't forget your towel. Like just, you know, calm down a little bit, not in the sense of like stop asking for change or be complacent, but in the sense of like, you know, it's going to be okay. You're going to make great contributions to the world in lots of different ways. You're smart and you're capable.
You are.
Yeah, so as a grad dean, and it's a little bit large or broad, but concern is on student well-being. And what you said, well, I was really close, so I will talk about something else. Well-being may be the self-confidence. Students may be not well or experience stress because of poor relationship with the supervisor, but let's focus on maybe something that it's more specific of humanities. Well, in my university is the isolation of the students. If they are not integrated in a research group or an institute, they have to find a way to form an informal community. So a year from now, I would like to see more community of learner in the universities, as well as between universities, from students, but also with mentors intervening, maybe in periphery, but to support the student.
A year from now, I'll be sitting somewhere in Italy on sabbatical. So,
wrong answer. So wrong answer.
So, but I do. I think what I'd like to see for the humanities is more iPlay. I'd like to see that a year from now, iPlay is not only successful at McGill, but the model is extended, and that we have actual success in getting the interdisciplinary graduate programs and options that are being proposed on the books to break down that isolation as a concrete step towards seeing in the humanities and social sciences what has already been happening for us at McGill in the neurosciences.
I hope a year from now, and I'm not saying why the hell aren't I on an Italian island somewhere with Tony. I would just conclude really all of this by saying that I hope the energy and passion and commitment and the contrariness, which is healthy, I think, and provocative, gets some kind of incremental generative buzz out there in the wider world, in our departments, in our programs, and a year from now, that there are more of us talking about this, because these intense sort of, you know, boot camps of intellectual self-reflection can easily sort of dissipate, and then, you know, you lose your focus and you're worried about other things. So let's, you know, let's take it out and continue the conversation. And I would just say, as a new provost, if you've got any ideas about networks of administrators to help, you know, generate or carry and direct this conversation forward, I'm open to that. So bring it on.
Please join me in thanking our panelists. I'll just say that on the part of SHRC, this is very much at the heart of our future challenge area of new ways of learning and teaching. We have a number of activities that are underway to facilitate discussions, to promote your ideas, to share your ideas. We've got a session at LACFAS. My colleague, Jean-François Fortin, will be moderating a panel with students at Congress. We have Leo Charbonneau from University Affairs also moderating a panel of among graduate students. So stay in touch with SHRC. Stay in touch with me. Continue seeing how you would like to perhaps participate in our future challenge areas. And again, you know, the humanities have a strong contribution to make across diverse sectors. So imagine yourself in that conversation. Over to the pub, right?